Right, good evening and welcome. My name is Dennis Rogers. I'm with the Geography Department here at the LSE, and it's my delight to be able to welcome you to this roundtable debate on terrorism and development. It's a very timely event, obviously, with the recent bombings in London, Sharm el-Sheikh, or Bali, as well as the almost daily bombings that are going on in Iraq. But it's a particularly timely event because a lot has been said recently, a lot which, if I may say so, is not terribly intelligent, about terrorism, about development, and about the whole notion of violence between East, West, North, South. This debate, which is hosted by DESTIN, the Development Studies Institute here at the LSE, and the Crisis States Research Center, which is a DFID-funded research center based in DESTIN, but autonomous, will hopefully break down some of these dichotomies, some of these stereotypes, which tend to sort of litter the debates which are going on in the media. The contributors tonight are very well positioned to introduce this debate because they all stand in different ways at the crux between studies of violence and crisis and development. The first five contributors tonight are all from the LSE, and they have all contributed to a special issue on terrorism and development of the Journal of International Development, which is one of the premier publications in the field. First, we have Professor Joe Beale, who is director of DESTIN, who has written an extremely interesting paper on cities and terrorism. Then we have James Putzel, who is the director of the Crisis States Research Center, who has written about the new imperialism of the US, which is one of the key issues undermining or underpinning the whole theme of terrorism today. Then we have Ben Wisner, who will be talking, not giving a paper as such, but more will be commenting on other people. Ben is an associate fellow at the Crisis States Research Center and a visiting professor of environmental studies at Oberlin University in Ohio. After Ben, we have Professor Jude Howell, who is director of the Center for Civil Society here at the LSE, who will present on terrorism, globalization, and civil society. And finally, we have Professor Ian Linden, who is associate professor with the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London. Each speaker will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor, the debate, to everybody who wants to participate. Now, without further ado, I will let Joe introduce the debate, introduce the main themes, before opening it up to everybody else.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's deliberations, hosted jointly by the Development Studies Institute at the LSE and the Crisis States Research Center, which is one of the two major research centers that we have within the Institute. I'm going to not talk to my paper on cities and development right now. You'll hear from me again on that. I just want to use this opportunity to introduce some of the key themes to the debate, drawing on the introduction that we wrote for the Journal of International Development special issue, we being myself, James Putzel, and Tom Goodfellow, who is sitting over there. And I want to just start by citing two statements made by international development cooperation agencies in the last year or so. The first is from Canadian CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency. Canadians who come from every corner of the globe understand that the life we enjoy in Canada depends increasingly on helping to make the world a better place. Canadians cannot be safe in an unstable world or healthy in a sick world, nor can we expect to remain prosperous in a poor world. Failure to achieve significant political, social, and environmental progress in the developing world will have an impact on Canada in terms of both our long-term security and our prosperity. Security and development are inextricably linked. The second is from Danish Development Aid, and the statement goes something like this: security is a necessary precondition for development. A contribution to the re-establishment of security and the promotion of peace in countries and regions where there previously was systematic violence, crime, and terror is an investment in poverty reduction and economic growth. Denmark is one of the first countries to establish clear principles for development activities against terrorism. Now, what's remarkable about these two statements is that they both come from development agencies which have the reputation for promoting pro-poor development, human rights agendas, and who have pushed the most benign of aid agendas in the world. And what they point to is a growing tendency to not only link security and development, but to link our security in the north with their development in the south. And this we come to in two ways. First, we see it as a new and worrying trend. But secondly, we see it as part of a long-term process whereby development and security have always been linked. Development grew up in the era of the Cold War. The first development decades, 1950s and 60s, saw development and security very much linked, saw development very much couched in Cold War terms and agendas. And during the 1970s particularly, there was a long, hard battle on the part of people working in bilateral and multilateral agencies to de-link development and security agendas. Of course, development aid has always been linked to the interests of donor nations. But by the mid-1970s, the explicit aim of overseas development assistance came to be seen as something promoting third world poverty reduction. We have a panel speaker. Okay. The important thing was that these agendas of poverty reduction and economic growth came to be seen as important issues in their own right, delinked from military and security agendas. And it's been a long, hard fight to keep those issues separated. And yet what we're seeing now is a re-emerging development security nexus. And at one level, it's hardly surprising given events of recent years, since 9/11, since the London bombings, since various wars where development and security agendas have become inextricably mixed. But we also point to another tendency, which is that during the 1990s, there were a lot of people who mourned the failure of post-Cold War development agendas to attain the same prominence as foreign policy, as other line ministries concerned with overseas issues, whether it was trade, the Ministry of Defense, and so on. So during the 1990s, in addition to pushing a development agenda, you got a strong push towards increasing development budgets, the significance of development in a joined-up thinking kind of way across government ministries. And in a way, what we have landed up with now is a case of be careful what you wish for. Because as development has grown in prominence, and as that has been accompanied by increased budgets for development aid, more and more other agencies, departments, and ministries have had an eye on that development budget. And so, for example, if you take the UK's Department for International Development, we had a highly successful Secretary of State for Development in the form of Clare Short, and the profile has been maintained by Hilary Benn. But what has happened is that the increased spending on development is something that the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs are looking at to see where joined-up thinking might equal joined-up budgets. So Ironically, it seems that just at the time when development funding is better than it has been for a very long time, the autonomy of development agencies administering ODA is under threat. What we do in the paper, and I'm not going to go into this in great detail, is we look to the extent that it's possible to discern at the relationship between development rhetoric and aid flows. Now, unfortunately, the OECD figures on development aid only go up to 2003, and most of the rhetoric about the development security nexus actually begins in 2004, 2005. So one cannot systematically trace aid flows versus military spending and how that has changed in response to the changing rhetoric. However, what it is possible to demonstrate is that across all development sectors, spending has increased towards countries that have a significant role to play in the war on terror, either as allies or as being maintained as neutral frontline states, or as non-Arab Muslim nations. And this is apparent not only with US aid, which is where you might expect this to be the case, but across the board. JICA, the Japanese aid, French aid, for example, always has been strongly supportive of Algeria, but this has increased since 2003, along with increased aid to Central Asia. Pakistan is now the highest recipient of aid out of all countries across a number of bilateral donors. I think we just need to say, I just want to say one more thing in relation to development aid and the security development nexus. And that is, it's not just about the foreign policy of bilateral donors, but it's also about the role of multilateral donors in a unipolar world. The World Bank and the UN both have quite serious hawks located there in the hierarchy by the Bush administration in the form of Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton, respectively. And this cannot go unnoticed and is bound to affect the relationship between security and development. What I've talked about mostly in this introduction is the war on terror, and I think that's appropriate because I'm going to hand over now to James Putzel, who is going to talk about US imperialism, and David Keane in the blue shirt, who hasn't yet been introduced, who's going to talk about the war on terror as well. And I will pick up, along with our other speakers, on aspects of terrorism and development more specifically in the latter part of the debate. So thank you.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm happy to see that the room is packed. I'm sorry about the people who were left outside. We were told that it's no longer can we have people sitting on the floor. And this is a change in recent years. But I hope that as this special issue of the Journal of International Development gets out, we can disseminate some of what we want to say tonight more widely. I'm talking to a paper that's entitled, and it's coming out in this journal, Cracks in the U.S. Empire, Multilateralism, Unilateralism, and the War on Terror. And I think this perspective is really rather important to inject into the discussion about the war on terror and about the phenomenon of political terrorism today. In the aftermath of the bombings of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in 2001, where 3,000 people were tragically killed, the Bush administration declared a war on terror. And in that, and on the basis of that war on terror, very quickly launched an invasion and occupation of Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban government that had been, you know, self-professed involved in sheltering Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network, who proclaimed responsibility for those attacks on New York. There was a fairly broad coalition behind the United States in that invasion, but less than a year and a half after that attack on New York, the Bush administration, under the banner of the war on terror, launched an invasion, an occupation of Iraq, closely supported by the government of the UK, with a much smaller, just a handful of countries backing it. Since then, the estimates of civilians killed, and the numbers are very bad on this, but is at least over 125,000 people, Iraqis, dead as a result of the invasion and occupation. Some 67 to 70,000 were civilians, another 50,000 were combatants, and some 3,000 were Iraqi police and military personnel working with the US. There's another almost 2,000 soldiers of the invading and occupying forces who have been killed up until the end of, or the beginning of September last month. The lion's share of those being US, as they make up the lion's share of the forces who are operating in Iraq. There's about 140,000 troops in the country, US troops in the country, in Iraq, and another 23,000 from more than 27 countries that are participating with the United States. There's a real brutality that's come across in the context of this invasion of Iraq. A brutal face of the United States that's been revealed to us through photos of US Marines shooting dead, defenseless old men as it occupied and emptied the town of Fallujah. The photos that have emerged from the prisons of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. So there's an ugly side to this imperial adventure that's begun to strike us and strike the public around the world. I situate this argument, this analysis of what's happening in the US against the writings of a number of different authors in the paper, and I don't have time to go into that. But just to mention perhaps three people who I talk about in more detail in the paper, who in a way encapsulate some of the opposing interpretations of what is going on in the US war on terror. The first is Michael Ignatieff. Many of you may know of him and his work, who essentially has argued about a US imperial project, but one that's benign, one that forms the context for humanitarian interventions now and in the future. Another is a recent book by Deepak Lal, who's an economist, who launched a serious attack on our profession some 20 years ago, the profession of development studies, who has written a book in defense of empire, and basically from an economic perspective argues that the US, again, is a benign power that has the possibility of ruling over a liberalized world economy now and in the future. The third author that I cite, and one to whom I'm more sympathetic, is Mamoun Mamdani, who's originally from Uganda, who's at Columbia University. He's written a book called Good Muslims, Bad Muslims. I think a very important book to read if one wants to understand the complexities of modern political terror. And Mamdani, he argues that we have to understand the United States' action in the tradition of Western imperialism, but he thinks that there's some very important distinctions in terms of the role the US is playing today. Most importantly, he argues that the United States, in its defense of democracy, in its defense of liberal markets, over the past few decades, has actually transgressed a line and opened the doors to political terror in its own actions around the world, its own military interventions. And we could talk about this and debate this in the discussion period, I think. In other words, they pursued an intervention internationally that violates international law and involves the application of what we know as collective punishment to those societies and political systems with whom it disagrees. Mamdani sees in the US a knee-jerk reaction over the past three decades to any expression of militant nationalism in the developing world. I think his argument is very important, but there are some ways in which I also would take my distance. All three of these authors argue that the US position in the world today is unassailable. And in a way, the unilateralism of the Bush administration is unassailable. And I try to argue, in what I've written in this paper, that there are real cracks in the US empire, that the economic foundations of US power are questionable and perhaps difficult to sustain over time. Moreover, I would argue, in a way that sometimes enrages the critics of the United States, that there really is a debate at the heart of the United States, and it's a debate that's reflected between what the Bush administration calls old Europe and the United States, and that's the debate between unilateralism and multilateralism. And a multilateralist position that was weakly defended by the critics of the invasion of Iraq among European state leaders, the multilateral position offers a different trajectory for the projection of what we might all agree are imperial interests. That debate, I think, is the most strategic one that's going on. It's a debate that exists inside the United States, around which the American population was polarized in the last election, but so far has not emerged victorious in the United States, and I would even argue has not been articulated very clearly. So it's a weak, there's a weak political opposition in the United States defending a position of multilateralism, or even weak multilateralism, that for me offers the only kind of hope to create a different kind of international context to rein in some of the more bellicose actions of the United States and perhaps begin to create a context in which the grounds for political terror begin to be removed. And so that's the argument I developed throughout the paper. Let me very quickly sketch some of the important points that I try to make here, and just to lay them out for the consideration of the audience and for any debate that we have which follows. I think the first point has to do with the consolidation of the US position under the Bush administration. I would argue it was a clear departure from what was being pursued by the Democratic administration earlier. And this departure is marked by the publication of the National Security Strategy of the George Bush White House in September 2002, just 1 year after 9/11. And in that National Security Strategy, there are three really crucial developments. The first was an unadulterated commitment to unilateral action, to unilateralism and a move away from multilateralism. The second was the doctrine advance of preemptive action. And the third, and much less talked about, was the commitment to an unconstrained proliferation, or not proliferation, but development of nuclear weapons technology by the United States. And on all three scores, I would argue this represented a departure, a kind of consolidation of a foreign policy, of a policy for imperial projection that's defended by those who we come to know as the neocons or the neoconservatives in the United States. The unilateralist position has been articulated by the US Department, Secretary of Department of State, Condoleezza Rice, and even before the Bush administration was elected during the campaign, she talked about an international community and that was illusory. A little recalling the discussion of Margaret Thatcher about society, there is no such thing as society. Anybody remember that? Condoleezza Rice said there's no such thing as an international community. That was the crux of the critique of the Clinton White House and the Clinton foreign policy. A doctrine of preemptive action that basically declared that the US could at any time, anywhere, attack anyone who in its estimation poses a potential threat to US national security. This stands in the face of and violates embryonic international law and opens the world to basically a world beyond law. And finally, the national security strategy celebrates the strategic agreement, arms agreement signed with between Bush and Putin which basically removed all limits on the expansion of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and something that I think needs a lot more attention, and I hope the students at the LSE might research into this and look at it more carefully. The second thing that I want to mention is the war in Iraq and the motivations that were involved in going into Iraq, the motivations of the United States. I don't have a lot of time to put all the arguments I put in the paper. Suffice it to say that, first of all, the arguments around weapons of mass destruction existing in Iraq have been totally disproven. But we knew it, and many of us wrote about it before the invasion occurred. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Secondly, arguments about human rights or the defense of human rights in the face of what was a tyrannical Saddam Hussein Ba'athist Party regime begin to pale and look rather sour, look rather hollow in light of the scale of deaths and violations of rights that have that have occurred in Iraq since the invasion began. Very difficult to defend the invasion on that score. I would argue that the Iraq war, the move into Iraq, represented a confluence of interests behind this coalition that came to power with George W. Bush. And we have plenty of evidence that before they even came to power, they were dead set on removing the Saddam Hussein Ba'athist Party regime in Iraq. I want to read one quote, even though I know I have very little time, because I think it's very striking. This comes from a strategy paper that was put together by leading interests within the Republican Party before Bush came into office. And they were summing up the situation in the Middle East and the situation of Iraq. And it said, the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. Goes on to say, from an American perspective, the value of such bases, that's bases in the Persian Gulf region, would endure even should Saddam pass from the scene. Over the long term, Iran may well prove as large a threat to U.S. interests in the Gulf as Iraq has. And even should U.S.-Iranian relations improve, retaining forward-based forces in the region would still be an essential element in U.S. security strategy, given the long-standing American interests in the region. There was a very determined group and a determined opinion to remove Saddam Hussein from a very early stage, long before 9/11. But also it's clear that the United States moved on Iraq to demonstrate its fortitude, its commitment to the doctrine of preemptive action, on the one hand, and also as a statement to the United Nations to say that U.S. power would no longer be constrained by worrying what happens at the Security Council of the United Nations. Finally, there was a motivation that very much was driven by a particular group within and behind the George Bush administration that simply defends the power of the fist in foreign policy. And I could say more about what that means in the discussion. There's a very important point that I have no time to really get into the details of that I make in the paper, and perhaps it's better because it's an argument based on numbers. But in terms of the strategic weakness of the United States, which I think needs to be injected into this discussion, I think we can see this in two principal factors. First of all, the United States lives at the level that it does, and U.S. military spending has reached the heights that it has because of the position of the U.S. dollar in the world economy. And I would argue that that position is very fragile indeed. The United States operates on a plummeting deficit, both a current account deficit that has meant that structurally it no longer is a leader in world exports. It's rivaled by Europe and Asia in that regard, and that even in imports, European countries from a much more balanced budget position are creeping up on the United States as a market for the world's products. The U.S. has a burgeoning government deficit that's reached $500 billion by the end of 2003 and continues to grow. And the only reason it can grow and sustain its it can continue to grow in that way, and the U.S. can sustain itself, is because the dollar is the currency of deposit internationally. We're all the world's savers. All the countries of the world guard their reserves in U.S. dollars. But this is a very fragile position, especially now that we have the euro internationally. We see the euro gaining as a currency of deposit at the moment, and we see the fundamentals of Europe much stronger in a way than the United States. This represents really some very basic cracks in the United States. However, at the present moment, if we look at the politics of Europe or if we look at the position of Asia, neither is in a position economically or militarily to challenge the U.S. hegemon tomorrow. And so almost by process of elimination, the only hope for a change in the direction of U.S. Interventions internationally and in the doctrine of preemptive war at the present moment seems to be down to what happens in the U.S. political arena. And that's where the debate between unilateralism and multilateralism could influence the future direction of international politics. At the moment, I don't end on a very optimistic note because we don't see a strategic policy articulated by the political opposition in the United States that really is believable at the present time. But nevertheless, I think that's where we have to look for some challenge to the U.S. and its current strategy of war on terror. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm sorry, I was a bit late. This is partly because I was detained under anti-terrorist legislation at the door. I had a bit of trouble convincing them that I was a speaker, which I think that no tie and yeah. Tells me that although I'm going grey, I'm not going grey enough. In terms of the, what I want to say, I have also written a paper for this journal, Journal of International Development. One of the reviewers said he didn't think I had anything to say about development, and he wondered whether that would be a problem for the editors, which is a call for Joe to make, I think. But development is a broad church anyway, so it may turn out to be relevant. I should say, Dennis asked me to introduce myself. So I'm David Keane, and I'm teaching complex emergencies here at LSE. One of the things I try to talk about in the paper is that I think there are important lessons to be learned from attempts to combat the use of terror within a range of civil wars. Lessons, for example, from Africa, or parts of Africa. And one of these is that proliferating weapons, and oftentimes a pretty deep-seated anger at political and economic exclusion, have fueled conflicts that I think can't be understood or addressed as a struggle between two teams, let alone between good and evil, as we are sometimes invited to believe. Another lesson, I think, is that abusive counterinsurgency, or counter-terror by extension, profoundly shapes patterns of violence in any given context, often attracting supporters to an otherwise or hitherto relatively weak rebellion. Now, you know that some US administration officials have optimistically compared Al-Qaeda to a snake that will die when the head is cut off. Other analysts, I think, argue more plausibly that the network resembles a kind of a mold you have to tackle the environment in which it grows. And this kind of war of analogies, often in the sense it's in analogies that are implicit rather than explicit, is quite crucial. I think it so happens in this case that the mold is a more apt analogy, and also that chopping off heads or chopping off, eliminating the leadership of Al-Qaeda, which has been an enterprise in which the US in particular has been actively involved, is something that, insofar as it succeeds in the immediate objective, tends to increase the decentralization of Al-Qaeda and actually to help to produce an organization which, in some sense, is more difficult to monitor or to control or to get a handle on. There is, I think, an assumption which we see often also in civil wars, in the war on terror, that the troublemakers are a discrete group of essentially evil individuals whose elimination will solve the problem. And part of what we have to do, and I'm probably preaching to the converted to a large extent, is to look at processes of becoming. And this, I think, demands a sense of history, a sense that often gets lost, a willingness to face up to the damaging effects of one's own nation, for example, political and military interventions over a long period. History, in a way, for Bush and Blair have been narcissized and projected into the future. When they speak of history, it's usually in terms of how history will judge their interventions, but I think we need another kind of discussion. As with civil wars in which politically and even militarily counterproductive tactics are prevalent, it's important, I think, not to take the expressed aims of the war on terror as a given, and to look at the functions of the violence and even the functions of the predictably counterproductive tactics in a certain amount of detail. And I think that includes, I don't really have time to get into a lot of detail, but political, economic, and psychological functions within the US, the UK, and a whole range of governments who have been, to a greater or lesser extent, recruited into this so-called war on terror. What you tend to find, I think, with civil wars in many parts of Africa is that the designation of a particular source of unrest or rebellion or evil provides a lot of opportunities for a whole range of actors within a very diverse counter-insurgency or counter-terror structure for abuses of their own. And the more universally despised the enemy, for example, the RUF in Sierra Leone that was doing all the amputations and so on, or Al-Qaeda itself, then the more likely it is that there are going to be very significant spheres of impunity which powerful actors are able to carve out for themselves within the context of an alleged counter-insurgency or counter-terror operation. So part of what I'm trying to do, and I'm not the only one, is to map that complicated coalition and to question the degree to which all the actors that make up that counter-terror coalition actually have a genuine interest in eliminating or weakening precisely the phenomenon which gives them the opportunity, as it were, to play other political and economic and psychological games that may stand them in good stead. So there's an idea there about looking at systems rather than contests. In terms of the, there are important, I think, shared dynamics between counterinsurgency and counter-terror networks. One of these is the prevalence, very often, of these counterproductive tactics, which predictably induce support for the named opposition. I think abusive counterinsurgency and counterterror tend to have the effect of knitting together what are often quite diverse grievances. Grievances among those whose targets for violence might otherwise be resolutely local. So, for example, Hugh Roberts has stressed that anti-American feelings are neither natural nor of long standing in countries like Algeria and Egypt, but that in some sense aggressive US actions have tended to superimpose an American enemy on top of local grievances. Revealingly, I think the idea that bad things are the responsibility of a few evil individuals has informed both the tactics in the war on terror and the official US response to revealed abuses like those at Abu Ghraib, which were dismissed, as you remember, as the work of a few bad apples. And the use of torture in third-party countries like Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia has also preserved, in a sense, the idea that bad things are the responsibility of, in inverted commas, them and not us. And these denials of responsibility are closely linked, I think, to a persistent tendency to exaggerate the decentralization of violence in relation to one's friends. And one can see this also in terms of the Cold War period, which was another war in which there was a designated and demonized enemy, and another war in which very valuable opportunities for abuse and exploitation arose for those collaborating in the struggle against this named enemy. So exaggerating the decentralization of violence among one's friends, and alongside this, an enduring habit of underplaying the decentralization of violence among one's enemies, in this case, the terrorists. So abuses in the counter-terror system, if they're admitted, are said to reflect a breakdown in the chain of command, while the enemy's abuses are said to reflect a ruthless imposition of command. And I think this mischaracterizes, for one thing, the nature of al-Qaeda. It sidesteps the responsibility of the West and also the widespread anger that has informed acts of terrorism. And what you have in some ways is a model which I equate with a kind of a rebirth of magical thinking in the West, which supposes that by eliminating a designated set of evil individuals, you can solve this particular problem. This is a kind of a rebirth of thinking associated with the old witch hunts. I think it centers very much on the idea of preemption, as James Putzel mentioned. Preemption, in turn, depends on the idea of being able to judge somebody's intention, which can take you into a sphere that is well beyond the sphere of evidence-based conclusions. Yeah, sorry, I've been told to finish up, and I think I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I was just woken up there because I didn't quite realise it was my turn. So, anyway, okay. I want to speak. I'll be fairly brief and talk about my paper in the JID, which is looking at the effects of the global war on terror on civil societies. And I'm going to make. First of all, I want to say that I take the global war on terror to be quite a complex term. Which has a range of meanings and functions, which of course makes it very malleable. So I think about the global war on terror as a mobilizing discourse which global and national leaders make full use of, as an expression of a polarizing vision of the world which pits modernity against backwardness, barbarity against civilization, and freedom against oppression. And a term that has a very militaristic content, the language itself, war, terror, and its association with preemptive military intervention. It also embodies the idea of a global political reordering, the reshuffling of global alliances and divisions among states in the world since 2001, and also, as Joe Beale pointed out, a new set of institutional and policy arrangements which gives rise to this rather disturbing nexus between development and security. And of course, in terms of the world of aid and development, the global war on terror has, as several of the speakers have pointed out, led to a change in the ideological justification of aid on the interconnections between development, security, and foreign policy, and also changes in the direction and flows of aid. So what then has been the effect on civil societies? Of course, it's very difficult to demonstrate any neat direct causal effects, though there already are some very visible explicit effects, which I'll talk about. But it's difficult to establish direct neat causal relationships because, in many ways, the processes that the global war on terror has kick-started are about the intangible creation of climates of opinion, of shifting attitudes, and the semantic construction and manipulation of others and enemies. I'm going to briefly mention three key effects of the global war on terror on civil society and development, and then talk about six key challenges that arise for civil society actors that need to be dealt with. Firstly, I think one of the main effects has been the constrictions of spaces in many countries, whether we're talking about the North or the South. Two things are important here. First, many governments have proved very skillful at deploying the language of terrorism to undermine and oppress perceived enemies. And although they may have done this a bit before, now the language of terrorism gives those efforts a new resonance and a stronger justificatory power. I'm thinking here, of course, in Uzbekistan, if you remember the uprising in Abidjan, where some of the people who participated in that have been depicted as terrorists. Similarly, in China, the secessionist movements in Xinjiang and Tibet are also cast in the mold of terrorist activities, extremist, terrorist, religious, and so on. Zimbabwe is another example. And more generally, many governments have, deploying the language of terror, have cast a veil of suspicion over civil society actors as potential terrorist fronts. If we take the case of the US, for example, the US has drawn up a list of specially designated global terrorist organizations. Interestingly, it's only Muslim charitable organizations that figure in this list. In Britain, there was investigation of the NGO Interpol, which is on the US list of global terrorist organizations. Yet when the Charity Commission investigated this case, they could find no evidence that Interpol was linked in any way to terrorism. And so the story goes on. And I think what is disturbing is that the targeting of Muslim organizations in this way creates a tendency to construct groups in which Muslims participate as having some affinity to terrorism. It creates the notion of the dangerous other and ultimately undermines the rights of Muslims to associate and organize and be part of civil society. A second key effect has been the suspicion that's been cast upon relations between northern and southern NGOs. And this can be seen in the crude, very crude surveillance and monitoring of links between donor agencies, foundations, bilateral agencies, and so on, and NGOs in the north and south. To give you a very explicit example, all US donor agencies, be they bilateral agencies, NGOs, or foundations, are expected to make sure that their partner organizations in the south do not have any links in associations with so-called terrorist organizations. And for example, USAID requires all its partner organizations to sign an anti-terrorist certificate saying that they have no links to any terrorist organizations or that none of their employees in their offices are associated in any way with terrorism. And of course, this has had knock-on effects of money being withdrawn from some NGOs, for example, operating in Palestine, because they cannot show that they are linked, they're not linked to terrorism. And recently I was talking to some people in Oxfam who were telling me about similar story about some NGOs in Palestine which have refused to take US money because they don't feel they can be absolutely firm in signing the certificate because it's almost impossible to know. Similarly, in other countries, Russia, Uzbekistan, China, moves are also being taken against NGOs. Putin, for example, in 2003 and again in July 2005, came out strongly against Western NGOs and their strategies in the former Soviet republics, and in particular linking Western NGOs to democratization agendas. Of course, we know that US NGOs have a big role in democratization agendas in the former Soviet republics, but linking this also to regime change, and that they played some fundamental role in the color revolutions of Kyrgyzstan, Georgia, Ukraine. And interestingly, in the case of China, the Chinese government has also become quite worried about these color revolutions and the role of Western NGOs and local NGOs in China, and is very concerned that these may be playing a rather different role than they are presenting, and has instigated investigations of foreign NGOs and local organizations in China during this year. The third key effect is around this issue of humanitarian intervention, some of the issues that both Joe and David have talked about in their papers, and the key issues around how to maintain the principles of neutrality, impartiality, and independence. This is a very live and issue in Afghanistan and Iraq, where the military are increasingly playing a role in relief and development work, which is very confusing indeed on the ground. That's a whole subject in itself, but it obviously presents a lot of dangers to humanitarian, NGO humanitarian workers who are working in the field. Okay, what are the implications of all of this, some of these very immediate consequences for civil society actors? I think there are a number of challenges, and I'll briefly draw your attention to these. First of all, there's a big issue like how, as a donor agency, how do you handle the monitoring of award holders and a receiver of donor money? How do you handle that? And what is the effect of this on the relationship between grant givers and grantees? How do you maintain trust when there's this air of suspicion surrounding your activities? Apart from, of course, the administrative burden of trying to manage this, I've heard that various foundations and have found it a big administrative burden to try and sort out all of these anti-terrorist certificates and so on. For humanitarian workers, there's a big issue about how to maintain a commitment to the principles of neutrality and impartiality. I think it's not enough to reassert a code of conduct, but in the longer term, we need to look much more closely at the role of humanitarian agencies in the foreign policy agenda of the countries, and devote more time to understanding the complex politics of the countries where they're operating, and maybe in particular to clarify the identities. Are organizations operating as nationless international organizations or national agencies operating internationally? The third point is that NGOs, social movements, and activists need to think about how to continue to organize, advocate, and campaign around marginalized interests, particularly where certain groups and certain issues are constructed as linked with terrorism. My fourth point is that development agencies, which have had a somewhat benign and euphoric approach to civil society organizations in the 1990s, are going to actually become much more conservative in their choice of partners to work with, and that in that process, the voices and interests of more marginal groups that may be seen as a bit risque are left out, and that the spaces for participation and inclusion that were prized open in the 1990s are going to be increasingly constricted. For advocates of particular causes, I think it's very important to remain on the alert, whether we're talking about refugees, asylum seekers, Palestine, secessionist movements, or whatever. And there are particular challenges here about how you continue to advocate around marginalized issues, how you keep things on the political agenda when the governments of different countries and global actors are trying to present those issues as not political, but as an economic problem or as a cultural problem. So it raises a lot of questions about how you frame your demands, how you shape your questions, how you seize the discord in this new context. And linked to that, I think we also have to remain alert to what is happening in countries that are the new allies of the United States or other Western powers, where any human rights abuses or restrictions on civil society will be rather conveniently overlooked. And I think Uzbekistan, until recently, was a very good example of that. And therefore, I think, as in the Cold War period, we have to remain alert to what is going on in the countries of so-called allies as well. And my final point is really about issues of accountability and legitimacy of civil society organizations, which in any case has become an important issue over the last few years. And I think in this situation, NGOs actually do need to be ahead of governments and to get their own houses in order. So in a nutshell, I think that civil society groups, actors, organizations need to be actually more proactive and more organized, more strategic in defending and expanding the spaces for dialogue and engagement, and for determining the rules underlying how groups within civil society, how donors and civil society relate to each other, and how the states in any particular context and civil society relate to each other. So it's time to move away from defensive, reactive reactions and move towards strategic thinking and positioning. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to be very brief and just say something about the relationship between cities, terrorism, and development. I think the history of warfare has always seen cities as sites of both protection and sites of attack. The Twin Towers events of September 2001 made it very clear that cities were also vulnerable to terrorism. Now, this was nothing that hadn't happened before, but it demonstrated this fact very, very clearly. In the burgeoning literature on the war on terror that came in the wake of 9/11, there was a lot written on cities, but it was all written on cities of the North, of the global North. And what I argue in my paper in the Journal of International Development is that cities of the global south are important to understand if we're going to understand anything
about the urban dynamics of terror and development. And yet, when reference is made to cities of the global south, it's invariably in terms of breeding grounds for terrorists or hiding places for radical Islamists. But what I try to point out is that cities of the south have themselves been targets both of episodic and sustained acts of terror. And I'm thinking here of Mumbai and Bogota and Karachi and Kabul, amongst many others. What's important in terms of focusing on cities is that the London bombings of July this year demonstrated just how interlinked terrorist networks are and how they span very permeable borders. So from Leeds to Karachi to Lahore and finally London, the planning and execution of those bombings operated across cities as nodes, as links in international networks. Now, I know that addressing issues of terrorism and development gets us into very tricky ground, very tricky definitional ground. And I want to make it clear as to how I'm using the definition of terrorism here. And I'm referring specifically to terrorist acts rather than terrorist actors. In order to avoid, A, the vexed question of when one person's terrorist becomes another person's freedom fighter, and secondly, to disassociate my analysis from the more essentialist analysis linked to the war on terror. I'm happy to come back to this in discussion. What's important is that the geography of terror has moved onto the global stage by way of cities, by way of cities that represent specific urban symbols. The message of the London bombers, for example, was that any war perceived to have its origins in London would come back to roost in London. And this is that makes it very difficult to challenge the development security nexus. It's important to say something about why the city is important with regard to acts of terror. One aspect is its physical, the physical environment of cities, the density of populations, the symbols of urbanism and urban life and urban power. Cities are important because they are the engines of economic growth for most national economies. And in addition, economies of scale can be derived from cities in terms of reaching the welfare objectives of states. In other words, infrastructure, basic services, and so on in a city reaches more people than if they were extended to villages. So this means that cities are important as symbols. Terrorists are not going to blow up a village, no one would notice. And what this in turn points to is that terrorism is both an act perpetrated on urban residents, but also something of an international language itself. The second point I want to make in relation to cities is that we need to differentiate between cities of the north and south. Cities of the south actually have experienced far more terrorist attacks than cities of the north. Some of these attacks are of domestic origin, but in such cases often have got caught up and translated through the discourse of the war on terror to become internationally linked, whether or not they are. Secondly, the vulnerability of urban citizens differs from cities of the north and to cities of the south. And within cities, it is often the everyday people on their way to work on the tube or people living in hazardous conditions in crowded slums and so on who are the innocent victims of acts of terror.
In looking at terrorism in relation to the other hazards and risks and vulnerabilities facing urban populations in cities of the South, it's important to recognize that terrorism is only one kind of urban violence that they face. Cities are also sites of political conflict and opposition and civil war, as both Jude and David have talked about. There is violent conflict in cities over resources that are scant and scarce. And those kinds of battles can intermesh with other forms of urban violence, like criminal violence, gang warfare, and other features of the brittleness of urban life for the urban poor. And I think it's important that violent conflicts such as these should not be confused with internationally linked terrorism, although in the rhetoric of the war on terror, they often are. Here, too, we have to see terrorism as just one of many other risks. Risks associated with environmental hazards, poor people in shacks on the sides of cliffs that suffer landslides, or that live in industrial areas and face petrochemical explosions. And I think one thing that's useful here is to make a distinction, not only between different forms of risk, but in trying to underpin what constitutes the difference between cities in developing countries and cities in the north, to make a distinction between the notion of vulnerability and risk. Whereas the vulnerability for people in cities of the south, and especially for the poor, vulnerability is far greater. Whereas what terrorism is doing in terms of risk is leveling the playing field. I think the only other point I want to make in relation to cities and terror is that I include in my definition the notion of state terrorism. This is controversial, and some people would argue that what I call state terrorism is in fact a violation of human rights by states. Nevertheless, I choose to talk about state terrorism because the kinds of acts of ethnic cleansing and urban cleansing, such as we have seen in Harare, where whole areas of urban settlement have been destroyed by the Mugabe government, that to me is an act of terror. But this is, again, something we can come back to in discussion. In terms of the impact of terrorism on development, I think it does two things, and this is to come back to this distinction between vulnerability and risk. It increases the vulnerability of poor people. It is far more difficult for cities of the South to recover from destruction. Reconstruction takes longer. It diverts resources from other areas of development spending towards reconstruction rather than development. States that are seen as terrorist or as failed states have resources withdrawn from bilateral donors. When you have, and that again reduces spending on development. And when you have a situation of high risk and high insecurity, you have an increase in gated communities, the better off closing down, shutting up, building walls around themselves and disengaging from development cooperation, disengaging from working with governments, disengaging from paying their municipal taxes, and so you have a breakdown in governance and democracy. And that is one of the biggest casualties of terrorism for development.
I haven't said anything yet, and already half of you have left the room. I'm deeply disturbed. Thank you for all coming, and thank you for being such a patient and attentive audience. Hopefully we'll draw this to a conclusion fairly soon and hear from you, which is very important. I learned my rhetorical style from Fidel Castro. I had a seven-hour presentation prepared, and I've been told by my friend Dennis I only have 10 minutes. So let me try. I work in disaster risk management, and I work as an advisor to the Secretariat of the United Nations Strategy for Disaster Reduction and the newly founded United Nations Center in Bonn, which is a research and training center on environment and human security. And I'm going to talk about one of the additional cracks in U.S. imperialism, which is in fact a crack at home, which is visible through the through Hurricane Katrina, and the way in which the war on terrorism has actually eroded the capacity of nations around the world, in fact, to deal with vulnerability and with risk that is really daily and chronic and episodic and much more frequent than terrorist attacks. But let me back up and make a couple of more general points. And I do so in awareness that many of you are master's and PhD students, and I always like to sort of throw out some seeds of sort of, you know, I'm going to throw out a dozen seeds for really, really wonderful dissertations and studies and books, and please go off and do some of these things. I think James also did that. Terrorism and counterterrorism have a long and complex interrelationship with development, underdevelopment, and I would say properly with maldevelopment. If one defines terrorism as acts intended to produce mass casualties among civilians in situations of political conflict, the history of the relationship is ancient. Khalid Carr, in his book *The Lessons of Terror*, proposes a broad definition of terrorism. He says this should be conceived as a contemporary name given to and the modern permutation of warfare deliberately waged against civilians with the purpose of destroying their will to support either their leaders or policies the agents of such violence find objectionable. Now, in this broad sense, this definition is applicable certainly, for instance, to the wars of national liberation in Algeria, Vietnam, and Mozambique, and the struggle against apartheid. And I think as such, it's extremely important for us to look at the long-term impacts of the form of development that those successful revolutions came to practice. In particular, what you got there, but as well in the Soviet Union, Cuba, China, and a number of other places, in where national development was emerged from the cauldron of terror and counterterror, you got an initial centralism and commandist modernizationist stance toward development, which in fact seriously molded the development of five-year plans and the entire sort of project of development for, in some cases, decades. And I think it's important to look back at that as a heritage of the relationship between development and terror and counter-terror. But moving on to another important point, and this is just to add perhaps a gloss or a footnote to the whole notion of the seedbed or the breeding ground of terrorism that James and Joe and others have mentioned. I'm teaching a seminar at the moment at Oberlin College on food security, and I've been reading a wonderful book called Food Wars that an old friend of mine, Tim Lang, and Michael Heisman wrote a couple of years ago. And in that book, they show that in many, many countries of the Middle East and Asia, we have simultaneously at this moment an epidemic of obesity in children, side by side with continuing chronic stunting and wasting of children. In fact, in Egypt, for instance, between 1978 and 1996, child obesity has quadrupled increased 4 times at the same time that you have continuing patterns of undernutrition. Now, I would submit that this is for middle class and working class recruits to whatever you might call terrorist organizations, a very, very offensive kind of symbol of Westernization and Americanization. And it goes hand in hand with the fact that the state, in many cases, such as the Egyptian state, cannot, in fact, provide the safety net and the basic services for people who are the losers in the global economic globalization process. In fact, quite the contrary, Islamic organizations, the NGOs that other speakers were referring to, are providing some of the basic health, agricultural extension, and other services, educational services, in these communities. And I think that the conjunction of the two actually have to be considered as part and parcel of the causal network that actually is producing what we see as this contemporary terrorism. But turning to my own field of practice and study, which is natural hazards management, let me put the question I would ask about terrorism and development this way. What impact has the war on terrorism had on the worldwide project of disaster risk reduction heralded by the meeting in Kobe, Japan in January 2005? And this, in fact, overlaps quite a bit and maybe amplifies something that David Keene was talking about in relation to complex emergencies. In fact, the World Disaster Report 2005 was just published a few days ago. I wrote chapter 2, actually, in that, which is on the hurricanes in 2004 in the Caribbean. The overarching pattern shows that in the last 2 decades, people affected by disasters has gone up by about 60%. Now, it doesn't mean there are more disasters. I mean, Mother Nature is not sort of playing up in an unusual way. It's the same old Mother Earth, with the possible exception of some increased intensity of cyclonic storms, but not their frequency. But basically, disasters are constant. What is increasing is the number of people vulnerable to those disasters, to use the same word that Joe Beale used. And in facing up to this challenge, the World Conference in Kobe actually put forward a very ambitious view of a disaster risk reduction, which would include, in fact, serious work on the Millennium Development Goals, management of conflict, and reduction of global warming while, in fact, adapting to its impacts. Now, this, I mean, that probably doesn't sound like a terribly ambitious kind of final, you know, document, but nevertheless, you know, the drafting committee was, of course, you know, spending 20 hours a day trying to argue the Americans into some sensible position. I mean, it's very difficult, as James said. But nevertheless, this actually is quite ambitious, even though the Americans insisted there would be no targets, et cetera, no new money, no, you know. But nevertheless, this is a new vision, that disaster risk reduction is part and parcel and has to be mainstreamed as part of sustainable human development. Now, this has extremely important legal, international, institutional, and programmatic implications. And the so-called war on terror actually undercuts the whole thing. And it undercuts it, and I'll be very brief, I have 1 minute, undercuts it in 2 ways. First of all, over the last 15 or 20 years, there's been a general move from military-based disaster organizations in countries to civilian-based disaster organizations. The military-based organizations work on the basis of command and control, and they're mostly interested in immediate response. And that the general tendency has been to civilianize them and to mandate them to work on prevention, long-term prevention, mitigation of risk, reducing the vulnerability, and preparedness. And this had been going along really quite well driven by a lot of assistance from the United Nations and by regional organizations such as SIDERA in the Caribbean and SIPREDNAC, if you'll excuse the long acronym, in Central America after Hurricane Mitch. Now, in fact, the U.S. Southern Command throughout Latin America is going around now saying, let's go back to military-centric disaster reduction organizations. In East Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania, the sites of two embassy bombings within the last decade, the U.S. has provided enormous amounts of assistance for hospital triage in urban emergencies and for terrorist response in countries that don't even have significant nationwide networks for dealing with drought and flood, okay, and that don't have the public health infrastructure, even the basic primary health care infrastructure to deal with challenges such as cholera, increasing malaria as global climate change changes the habitat of the Anopheles mosquito, or of avian flu. The second way that the war on terror has undermined the capacity to deal with these daily disasters, really, or at least hazards that hang over people's lives in a daily way, and they manifest maybe every 5 years as a major flood or a major hurricane or a major drought, is that resources have been cut back. Now, this brings me to Hurricane Katrina, and I won't sort of go through all the tragic and deplorable scene that you've all sort of witnessed in various forms on television and read about. But let me say that I used to work with FEMA at a certain point. And beginning with the Bush administration before 9/11, but certainly accelerating afterwards when FEMA was absorbed into what many people refer to as the Homeland Security Borg, okay, the super agency, FEMA lost many, many, many of its experienced people. They just couldn't take it. I mean, I bailed out even before that. They also lost a significant amount of their budget to other agencies within the Homeland Security super department. And as a result, we all saw the inability of FEMA to respond to the hurricane, to Hurricane Katrina, which was known in advance. We saw it coming. We had 3 days' notice, and they couldn't respond afterwards. Let me say in conclusion that the causes of contemporary terrorism are likely to include much more than poverty or simply the lack of development. More likely implicated are polarized development, economic development, and social development in situations where the state is weak and cannot provide compensatory assistance to those at the bottom, the losers in the process, and that the other way around, the current monomania and fixation on terrorism is further undermining the ability of many states to meet the needs of the majority of their citizens, who are much more likely to suffer drought, flood, earthquake, blizzards, and not to mention hunger, waterborne disease, and HIV/AIDS than terrorist attack. The failure to protect citizens from natural hazards further delegitimizes the state. And I think that's a big problem we have to concern ourselves with in relation to the Crisis States Program. Thank you very much.
Now, most of my friends in the 1980s were terrorists, so I take this all very personally. I think it's rather odd that in the context of 2005, we've been having a debate along the table, which has been in many ways ignoring religion, in many ways marginalizing religion. We've conflated the sort of the 1980s, the terrorism of various organizations that might or might not have been involved in nationalist activities. And we've, as it were, I think largely because we're in a very secular university, we've sort of marginalized Islam, which is very odd indeed. At the very most, I think we can say that we would create a very one-dimensional analysis of what's happening. If you don't understand evangelical Christianity and its dynamics in the States, if you do not understand jihadist Islam, in North Africa and the Middle East, Indonesia and other places, you are not, you might say, going to understand very much about what's happening at the moment. That's perhaps putting it a little strongly. In definitional terms, the whole story, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, is perhaps a very trivial and unimportant point, though it's messed up any United Nations definition of terrorism for a very long time because of the Arab states. On the other hand, one woman's terrorist is another woman's holy martyr. It does seem to me is of significant importance because it's vital if you are dealing with religion, which involves narratives, practices, virtues, life worlds, and symbols embedded in historical experiences in particular religious communities. If you are dealing with that, and if you are dealing with what evolves out of that in certain aberrant manifestations, feeding on the ambiguity of violence within all religions, then it seems to me you do have to understand the context, the meanings, and the dynamics within important religious systems that are relevant at the moment. And obviously, evangelical Christianity, jihadist Islam are very important. Ayman Zawahiri, second in command in what is left of the core group in Al-Qaeda, spends an awful lot of time working with an apologetical position on what is essentially just war theory mediated into the Islamic tradition. And the whole analytical, definitional account of terrorism, which is all about killing of innocent civilians, though of course the agency was very important in definitional terms. Was it a national group or was it a subnational group? But the core of it is the calculated, deliberate killing of innocent civilians for political, economic, and other goals. Now, Ayman Zawahiri spends a lot of time explaining, of course, that if you're dealing with Israel, you are simply dealing with soldiers who temporarily take their uniforms off because you have a conscript army. If you're dealing with Britain and the United States, you're dealing with people who vote the defense budget, who vote the collusion with the Israeli government, who vote the foreign policies that involve the invasion of Muslim lands and so on. So what is the degree to which they are innocent within the framework of a jihad conception? Ironically, a lot of this jihadist thinking is extremely westernized because it moves from a Muslim concept of a communitarian responsibility to defend Islam, to defend the holy places, to a highly individualistic one. The move from Osama bin Laden's statement in 96 through to his statement in 98. 96 he declares jihad on the United States of America after the failure, essentially, of nationalist jihadist struggles in the Middle East and North Africa. He moves from a communitarian responsibility to an individual responsibility, creating in the actual idea and action of jihad a core symbolic action-oriented position within Islam, turning Islam, as it were, into a religion of resistance focused on jihad. In one interview, he says, jihad, I want it to be like a worship. It's that central in the thinking. It's that distorted in terms of the Islamic tradition. So if you're waging a war on Islam, what is more important, all those lads from Kentucky blundering around Iraq? Or is it somebody like Yusuf al-Qaradawi, big speaker on Al Jazeera, who says no, the suicide bombing in Israel, that is different. There's a war going on, it's defensive, the Palestinian people are defending themselves. The attack on the United States is totally inadmissible. And he is coming out of a sort of a semi-jihadist tradition on Al Jazeera, around the world, into Muslim community. People are listening. That is infinitely more important in terms of a war on terror than anything that is going on by the imposition of armed force on populations in the Middle East. Going over to the evangelical Christian side, I don't think we should exaggerate its importance in the United States of America. But if you look at the dynamics of American foreign policy, the sort of shifts from unilateralism to to multilateralism, to unilateralism again. You can see the period after the Second World War was strongly dominated by a multilateralist conception, the support for the United Nations. And it had a strong kind of Episcopalian, Presbyterian support. Group of church leaders in 41 set up the Committee for the Restoration of, I always forget the exact title, Restoration of a Just and Lasting Peace. And they had three major things that they were going for, lobbying advocacy for in government. One was the establishment of a solid body of international law. Secondly, the creation of a United Nations Charter on Human Rights. They wanted a charter of human rights. And the third, which actually sort of happened as well, was a trusteeship body for decolonization in different parts of the world. They got it. They got it in the United Nations. The evangelical Christian influence on United States foreign policy is very different. I mean, just telling you those three characteristics of that particular period, you can see just how different it is. I want to leave you with two, as it were, sort of thoughts for the day, little snippets, factoids, I believe they call it on Radio 1. One little factoid, Mohammed Atta, the key player in the 9/11 attacks, guess what his doctoral dissertation was on? Somebody in the room probably knows. It was on, let me read it out for you, it was on the analysis of Islamo-Christian architectural fabric in Aleppo, Syria. And he was very much in, this is for Jo, because she's very interested in towns. And he was doing an analysis of the way the sort of the architecture and the town planning by bringing Christians and Muslims together was a very important and significant feature of the city. And he was entirely not in favor of separation. I mean, he wasn't a sort of Sayyid Qutb sort of man, or, and he certainly wasn't within that separation tradition. Whereas Ayman Zawahiri, coming out of that Egyptian tradition, was. And I had one other lovely factoid for you, which I don't know whether I can find in the time. Oh yes, another lovely one. When they took one of the computers in Kabul, and the security people grabbed a computer in an allegedly Al-Qaeda house, it had on it, guess what? Menachem Begin's 1951 autobiography, The Revolt, because they were terribly interested in how the Ergun did their terrorism in that particular post-war period. I'll just leave you with those two factoids.
Thank you very much. Now, we have about 25 minutes left, and what I suggest is I'll take three or four questions, depending on how many people have some, in one go. Give the speakers a couple of minutes each to come back on them. And then open up the floor again for a few more questions. So, questions, please. I believe we have a microphone.
Hello. Spunk. Would the panel think that in the history of the Middle East, there's a long tradition of every country being dominated by tyrants, and therefore Saddam, the Shah, Ottoman Empire, USA is just another tyrant?
Anybody else? Over there.
Yeah, I have a question to Dr. Patel. I very much agree with your analysis about the cracks of US imperialism, but I have a question about your solution. Where you talk about a multinational, a multilateral solution sort of coming from within the United States. I would like to ask why you think that didn't gain the upper hand domestically. And maybe also a question that combines Professor Joe Beal's introductory presentation and a comment by Dr. Keane. When David Keane spoke about the comparison of the snake and the mold, isn't the mold exactly what the EU security strategy or what the Canadian and the Danish development centers are all about, bringing development or creating opportunities for those who are marginalized, what is also called draining the swamp? Thank you.
Over here. And then over there. I'll come back to you.
Hello. I just wanted to ask a question to Joe Beal about the stuff about cities, whether there were any more positive sides of cities that we can look at in context of the war on terrorism, if we can bring out some of the positive roles that cities can play that you might not be able to see at a national level. And also what the city stuff you were talking about might tell us about the kind of concept of a developed and developing world as two separate worlds, which is obviously quite damaging in that it leads to a distinction between terror, counter-terror, and those kinds of issues for anyone really on the panel.
Okay, let's have that question, and then we'll come back to you two in the second round.
Good evening, thank you. I want to raise a question because development. We want to make the world better from the law to the soul. We help each other, but my question is a little bit not easy to ask because I want to. How do we rebuild our active cooperation? How do we rebuild an active cooperation between the law and soul after the September 11th? Because sometimes there are some big choice and some big digression in our global development. Because how do we build and we look a new practical direction in our global development again? Because normally by global development, we emphasize on the IT and economy. But how about human rights and liberty and freedom? This is some kind of problem, I don't know. Thank you.
Hi. Do you want to sort of have a minute to answer or two? And then we'll just go along and then we'll come back to the questions.
I'm going to be very brief because I'd like to hear more from the audience. I think the last question was about the implications for development cooperation, I think. And I think there are, it's very difficult to know what the implications are, except and how we can address issues in development cooperation more soundly. I think one of the things that we have to do is keep a watchdog role on development to make sure that too many resources are not spent on reconstruction as opposed to development, or that development and reconstruction objectives are combined, that money isn't funneled out of development budgets into military spending and so on. So that would be a brief answer to what I think I understood your question to be. On the positive side of cities, that's really important. Just as cities are sites of war and terror, they're also very important sites for reconstruction and peace building. And if you just think of Nicosia in Cyprus, the green line that divided the city above the ground, the sewers and the pipes and water and drainage under the ground still had to serve both Greek and Turkish populations. So it's very difficult to unbundle cities. If you take a recent meeting between the mayor of Taipei and the mayor of Shanghai, they were able to engage in ways that their national governments could never have done. And in the paper, I cite the example of someone who is in prison, a Hamas Hamas leader in prison who was elected mayor of a border town on the West Bank, and who, despite being seen as representative of a terrorist organization by the Israelis, was nevertheless engaged with in terms of issues of urban development, because the buses still and the trains still have to run on time. So there are immense areas of potential for using cities and the urban context towards reconstruction and peace building. I'm going to hand over now, so I don't hold the mic.
You have to speak quite close to the microphone.
Yeah, let me just respond in a general way to a number of the things that were asked, very perceptive, important questions. In relation to the reduction of conflict and international and intergroup tension as a precondition for development, for economic and social development, you might want to know about the existence of a website, and I can't. It's basically disaster diplomacy, all one word, disasterdiplomacy.org. Okay, if you go there, what you'll find is a friend of mine, Ilan Kelman, has actually begun to pull together all sorts of interesting historical cases where disaster response and experience has actually pulled countries together and actually begun to bridge conflicts. And in fact, the long civil war in Aceh in Indonesia has actually been, at least hopefully, successfully concluded in part, you know, pushed on by the terrible experience of the tsunami. I also want to call your attention to the existence in New York City of a small NGO called First Responders for Peace. These are actually a group of firefighters and emergency medical technicians who are against the war in Iraq. And they've actually gone to Iraq, and they've met several times with their counterparts and are campaigning together for an end to the war. So I think there are definite kind of links within civil society as well that can help move us in that direction. Finally, just let me say, in relation to this question of implication for development cooperation, I actually don't think that short of some terrorist using a dirty nuclear device in a city somewhere, the actual economic cost of recovery from any given terrorist attack is probably not going to be very high in relation to the cost of recovery from something like the tsunami or a major hurricane like the supercyclone in 1999 in Orissa in India, or Hurricane Katrina, or Hurricane Mitch, or for instance the Kobe earthquake. I think though that the important point is that we do maintain this watchdog role in relation to military and security spending, and try to keep the development agenda from being absorbed within the or reabsorbed from within the, inside the security agenda. In fact, quite the contrary, I think we should campaign to get, say, 10% of all the military budget in the world. Not much, just 10%. For instance, in the first instance, just to retrofit and protect schools. The thousands of school children died in Kashmir just a few weeks ago. Okay, that was not necessary. The engineering exists, the organization exists, pilot projects from the Aga Khan Foundation, the UN Center for Regional Development in Central Asia, all of this exists. We know how to protect schools. We know how to train local masons to protect schools. And it doesn't cost very much. It doesn't cost. It's not costly. 10% of the military budget could do that and could retrofit hospitals. In relation then to draining the swamp, I mean, how much goodwill would it produce to actually have schools and hospitals that didn't fall down in earthquakes?
Thank you. James, can you be brief?
Yeah, very brief. Is that on? Yeah? There were just two questions I wanted to comment on.
Is that on?
Yeah, I think it's on. In relationship to this idea that there's always been tyrants in the Middle East, is the U.S. just not another tyrant? Well, I would just say that if we look at the history of the region since World War II, we see that various nationalist movements emerged in Western Asia. And if anything, the stance taken by the United States towards them has tended to favor tyrants. So if we look at what the US did in Iran and its installation of the Shah of Iran, or if we look at Saddam Hussein himself, who was very much empowered and emboldened by the United States. So I think that there is a diversity, and there was more of a diversity in the nationalist movement in that part of the world, made much more restrictive by the attitude of not only the United States, but Britain and other Western powers vis-a-vis the politics there, and not least the kind of endorsement they gave to specific orientations of Israel and the Israeli government in terms of securing its position in the region. And I say that despite my relatives, who are very much believers in the Israeli project. The second thing I wanted to say was an answer to the question about multilateralism. Why didn't it gain the upper hand? Well, I think the first thing to say is the most proximate, and that is that the multilateralist position is weakly articulated by the Democratic Party, that the Clinton was a hesitant multilateralist at best, and we don't have a strong multilateralist position developed in the US. And I think why is also we have to understand that there is a powerful unilateralist tradition in the US, in US politics. And to some extent, Mamdani, I really do urge you to read his book. He gets into this in a way that similar to certain things I've written in the past, some of this comes out of the settler character of the US polity, where a whole nation was built on genocide of indigenous peoples, and a nation that hasn't yet come to terms with those origins. I think it has a very illiberal foreign policy since the days of Manifest Destiny. And so it's an uphill struggle to win the population over to a multilateralist position.
Right, I'm going to make an executive decision and actually stop the comments here, get the two questions there, and then start from the other side. You get at least three comments from the other people. So there's two questions there.
Okay, I have a question slightly getting away from the US, because I think it was also very interesting what was mentioned at the beginning, that other states also are recruited into this war of terrorism or not. Well, my question is, maybe it's not supposed to be sound fatalistic, but isn't it just unrealistic to assume that, well, any kind of policy field is just going to be unaffected by these waves of public attention, which are not just kind of a factor of, like, let's say, Bush manipulating the agenda. So I'm not trying to say that it's in every case justified, but isn't it also a case of just sitting back and waiting the thing out a little bit? Because, for example, I mean, if you look at some policies, which are at least rhetorically claimed in the European context, which actually, at least in general foreign policy terms, I'm not talking about specific NGOs, I just don't know enough about this, but at least so far, and to my knowledge, not all that much changes, and it's a lot of really just symbolic politics. Is it really all that alarmist what is happening? Let's talk about, you know, really aside from the US, where undoubtedly there has been a major sea change.
And there was a question at the back over there.
Hi, I'm just going to make a comment and a question. The comment is there seems to be, to me, a risk of getting confused between the risk of a terrorist act and the risk of a terrorist campaign. And it's about the risk of a terrorist campaign that I'm going to ask a quick question about. Terrorist campaigns obviously would be financed, and those financings would then be from a black market. And the question that I have to ask is, bearing that in mind, wouldn't it be appropriate for the military to be involved in order to deal with the proliferation of the black market? Because that would encourage an expansion of such things as arms and drugs. And therefore, there is a role for the military in dealing with development.
Are there any other questions? Can we, gentleman over there?
Uh, First, I'd like to agree with very much with Dr. James Potts' observation that the U.S. has played a part in the creation of the rogue states that it is now trying to take care of itself. But the question is, how would you predict the U.S.'s military presence with huge bases in northern Uganda and Djibouti for the development of the Horn of Africa and the sub-Saharan African region in general?
Right, and before I hand over, I'm just going to ask a quick question myself, which is, to a certain extent, this panel has actually created an opposition between terrorism and development, almost implicitly saying one is bad and the other one is good. If we have development, we'll have less terrorism. Of course, development is a very disruptive process. It comes with a lot of costs. I mean, it's about social change. There are winners and losers. Terrorism, of course, can be possibly provoked by development in many ways. So let's start with David. David, do you want to come up here where the microphone is?
Okay, well, I'm going to talk about the another executive decision. The comment about is the U.S. just another tyrant? Because that's the thing that got me thinking the most, in a way. And I think what that does is it raises the issue, which I think is very important, of what are the conditions in which democracy can be established. Now, in terms of British rule in Iraq and then subsequently in independent Iraq, I think you have had a situation of the predominance of a Sunni minority. And this historic predominance sits pretty uneasily with democracy. So if we're talking about, you know, is there a connection between authoritarianism and terrorism? I think there is. We have to look at US links to authoritarianism. We have to look at the career path, so to speak, of terrorists and the role, for example, of torture under authoritarian regimes in propelling people along that path. Where I think we have a problem is in the rather simplistic diagnosis of the Bush administration in particular, that if there is a link between authoritarianism and terrorism, then the forcible removal of authoritarianism and the forcible imposition of democracy will, in a sense, solve the problem. And I think one of the things that we're coming up against in Iraq now is the difficulty of imposing democracy very suddenly and by force on a country where there have been other traditions, other patterns of historical domination by particular ethnic and religious groups, and so on. And this, I think, was, you know, something that we're interested in very much in the Crisis States Research Program, the idea that it may be the imposition of democracy, if it's done very suddenly, can be something which precipitates various kinds of violence. You know, the example of Rwanda comes up and the genocide there in reaction partly to an attempt to impose democracy very quickly. So I think it's something that we have to think about. What are the links between authoritarianism and terrorism? But also, what are the links between rapid democratization and mass violence?
Okay, so I think we'll give Ian the last concluding word.
The first question, where do we go from here on well, it wasn't the first question on development cooperation, it was perhaps the most general question. Just to tell you a little bit about what the Ministry for International Development's doing in this country, I participated in a research program looking at the way in which Muslim organizations could participate in the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. Because on the whole, DFID had, by a sort of default position, tended to support secular and Christian NGOs in that order. The work that I did was largely in West Africa, and it was absolutely fascinating. It's very clear that Gellner is wrong in his in that lovely book on conditions of liberty about the incapacity of Islamic countries to create civil society. I mean, that's pretty clear in Egypt, where the Muslim Brothers have moved into a whole range of different organizations. They control the Bar Association. They work very well with Christian cops in the Pharmacists Association, in sort of what is a quasi-trades union. This is equally true in West Africa, where mosques form the basis of quite important social services and projects amongst progressive imams. And even the Dawah societies are doing some, you know, quite good science education and other work. There is such a thing as Islamic civil society. I mean, it would be preposterous if there wasn't. So that's the first thing I want to say, that I think the way forward developmentally is to understand the meanings and idioms and framework of what Muslims mean by development, and in dialogue with Muslim communities to try and promote some of the ideas of development that we may have as a quote-unquote development community, which may not correspond directly with those that are experienced and expressed by Muslims on the ground around the world. And obviously that's going to be enormously different in Indonesia to what it will be in the north of Nigeria. The second point I want to make is I was really amazed and delighted at what you said over there, because it seems to me that all the evidence indicates that there is no connection between poverty and terrorism, that in fact all the leadership of the recent wave of international terrorism has come from people who show many different characteristics and some similar ones, very often experience of different cultures, being a minority of a minority, inventing a religious discourse that is not embedded in a local community. These are all very much mobile people. I mean, a lot of the 9/11 bombers came from a pretty lowly clan in Saudi Arabia, the sort of car drivers and carpenters and maids and that. They were not sort of top of the sort of the ranking in terms of clans, but they were all very upwardly mobile and actually physically mobile. And like Sayyid Qutb, who went to the United States of America, they had great experience of other countries. And those factors are probably actually quite important. But your link between crime, collapsed states, and terrorism is obviously one that's acknowledged by all governments, except they don't. I don't know if you saw that lovely article on Jersey in the New York Review of Books. I mean, 500 billion mafia money, every dirty bit of money you could think of has gone through the beloved states of Jersey banks, just like it goes through the Cayman Islands and various other places. Now, if you're going to drain the swamp, it would be an awfully good idea to drain some of the Swiss bankers and some of the Jersey banks and fake front companies. That would be make a very, very good start. Waiting, somebody talked about, wouldn't it be a good idea to sort of, you know, stay your hand, sweet Maria, a minute when dealing with some of these very intractable problems? The answer is obviously yes, and as Niels Ferguson says, for a completely different reason, yes, if you haven't got a trained cadre within your society able to run an intelligent civil service in the country that you are supposedly going to sort of act as a trustee for and develop, you are going to make a hell of a mess. If you want to be a British imperialist in an American mode, create an American a British imperialist class in which there is a long training in working in these sort of imperial colonial contexts. And of course Ferguson is saying that because he actually thinks the Americans should do it. I wouldn't actually go along with that, but he's got a point. The catastrophe of Iraq is based precisely on ignorance and lack of experience in something that wasn't, it has to be said, shown to such a degree in Germany and Japan.
Well, thank you very much, Ian, and that wraps up the debate for tonight. Apologies for the academic terrorism of the timing, but if we could have a round of applause for our speakers for a mm-hmm.